Live from Burbank, California, where the Pope comes to buy gas. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now, it's hard being a pimp. Mark Maron.
Oh, man. What's up, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, need machines and pain sponges. Chocolate ain't so bad. Hey, we bring that box from in there, fellas? I was going to go over those presents that we got yesterday. We got some presents yesterday that I didn't do justice to, man, from King Kong in China. I don't know what kind of candy they like in China. Sweepy Bill Kohler is on his way in with the box. But I'll tell you something, man. It was a great day out there in the world of news. Great day. Denny Hastert in a back and forth. I mean, this happened yesterday afternoon. We had already recorded the show. I was so pissed off because I was at the Improv last night. Had a nice show. Good times.
Yeah, Improv? Is that some kind of comedy place?
What, are you going to act stupid now?
Will they do
is today stupid day? You know what it is.
Funny guys get up on
you've been up there. Remember back when you had the gleam in your eye and
tell
the,
jokes
and the dream in your heart? You and Barry must have done like an open mic at the Improv or perhaps a showcase for Bay Area comedians.
We did showcases at the Improv, yeah.
Yes, it's a comedy club, Jim. We had a nice time.
Who did you follow?
Michael Richards, Kramer from Seinfeld.
Really?
Yes, was who I followed. He did about 15 minutes. Yeah. Did fairly well. Michael Kramer's a hit or miss act. You know, he's got to follow his fame, and that's not easy for any of guys who are as well known as he is. But he did well. He did well. And B.J. Novak was on the show. B.J. Novak of The Office. He writes for The Office. He's on The Office.
Okay.
Young guy. Young whippersnapper. Doug Benson, who's been on our show, he was on. It was a good show. We had a good time. And when I get off stage, I was talking to some cat from D-Day blog who was telling me that this news broke about Hastert. I didn't even hear it. And we were talking for 2 days about why he might be reacting, why him and John Boehner and Democratic leadership within the House might be freaking out about the FBI investigating or coming into Congressman Jefferson's office and taking what they needed to take.
Yeah.
And the speculation was, what is this? They're going to take they're looking to get distance from the president, or are they indeed frightened for their own asses? And it turns out it might be the latter. And I know most of you probably already heard this, but I just wanted to have a moment to celebrate myself because this is Denny Hastert, Fat Denny Hastert. You know, soccer coach, wrestling coach, Denny Hastert, is now part of the corruption scandal. I mean, I'm under the impression, here's what happened. It went back and forth. ABC breaks a story that Dennis Hastert is under investigation by the FBI. All right, then bang, Hastert says, sends his spokesperson, says, no, we're not under investigation. That's crap. All right, and then bam, Hastert gets pissed off at the Justice Department, says they're being opportunistic and making him pay the price for stepping on their toes and trying to teach him a lesson. He says that. And then Hastert has threatened to sue ABC News for libel and defamation. But ABC sticking by their story, which means I don't know how deeply Hastert is under investigation by the FBI. I'm assuming that just about every Republican in that place is under investigation somehow because of these lobbyists and because of former Abramoff and DeLay cronies are ratting everyone out who even mildly or in a little bit just took a little bit of money.
So are you in favor or against?
Of?
The, you know, FBI going into the congressional offices.
I got no problem with it now.
No, you see, but you can't have it both ways.
Sure I can. I'm just a radio host.
Yeah, but, you know, that's hypocritical.
How is it hypocritical? What did I say before?
You said, hey, it was an outrage.
No, I didn't.
Separation of, you can't do that.
I didn't. I don't think.
It's an abuse of power.
No, I don't think I had an opinion on either way.
Really?
What I was trying to do yesterday, I think the conversation that you and I had was around what it meant, what the separation of powers meant, why were they mad, what was the transgression. And then we couldn't figure out what the politics of it were. You know, honestly, if it is a transgression of checks and balances, I have a problem with it. I do. I think that, you know, I'm no constitutional expert, but it seems that if it is an infraction upon the separation of powers and the checks and balances principle, then I do have a problem with it. I am excited, though, now, and I'm not sure whether this would have come out eventually anyways. If Dennis Hastert is truly under investigation, I'm glad to know it now. We would have known it eventually anyway, especially if he got nailed. The reason he's probably freaking out is that he might just be have been mentioned. It may not have been proven that he has done anything wrong, but his name has come up in this investigation, as I was saying before, like every other Republican in the House.
Now he's threatening to sue ABC.
Well, he's freaking out because if, in fact, he isn't guilty of anything, which I find that hard to believe, he is the Speaker of the House, or, you know, they're mostly guilty of something. If he's not guilty of something, this is going to stick to him. And so be it. Let the slander stick, but it's not slander. I'm sure he's been mentioned in the investigation, as has everybody in that place. As I was getting to before, here's a couple of things I want you to know. It's only going to matter to those of you who are able to hear the show at this particular moment. On the show tonight, Dean Baker, economist and author of The Conservative Nanny State. This is no good with economics, barely any good with really the political system in general. Learning as I go along, as many of you know. So this guy's going to have to talk to me like I'm a moron in order for me to understand exactly what he's saying. But the implications of it, I think you put it best before the show, Jim. He's talking about a corporate welfare state, essentially.
Yes.
Yeah. Also, El Nino, Christian and Laz from the Latino, a metal band. El Nino will be here to talk about immigration, about metal, about being Latino metal. It's very interesting to me. Now, I don't know if it's true or not. But a lot of the kids in my neighborhood, I live in a primarily Latino neighborhood, are very into the metal. And you can tell metalhead kids because they got the long hair, they're wearing the T-shirts with the skulls and the Slayer and the Megadeth and the, you know, whoever the new bands are. Back when I was a kid growing up in New Mexico, the Chicano trip was primarily cholo or disco. Granted, there was a different time. But I have this idea that one of the reasons why Latino kids, outside of just being kids, are attracted to metal is I think there's a tradition, certainly in Mexico, with skull imagery around Day of the Dead and also wrestling culture. And I think that the theatrics of wrestling and the sort of legacy, historical legacy of skull imagery has some sort of appeal. Then, of course, there's the metal music itself.
In my neighborhood, it's primarily the oompa music.
Oompa oompa? The conjunto music?
Yeah. Is that what you call it? Yeah. Never gets tiring.
The accordion solo.
Yeah, you know, we got the Germans to blame for that.
That Germans in Texas are to blame for that. That's absolutely true. But I think it's great. I love conjunto music.
I like it, you know, up to a certain point. Then I just want to, you know,
I like
scream
it when
and run.
I like it when it comes out of an AM speaker in an old, maybe a Chevy Impala. It sounds best back when I was coming up, when the lowriders didn't have these damn bass woofer things that shook the whole damn block. They just had a couple of Jensen triaxles or coaxles in the back of those 62 Impalas bouncing up and down, and had a different sound, man. Had a different sound.
I don't know what you're talking about, man. You're way over my head.
What do you mean I'm over your head? You grew up.
How old are you?
You grew up in Southern California.
Yeah.
New Mexico is like the lowrider capital of the world. You don't remember lowriders? Where did you grow up? In Whiteland?
Claremont Colleges. Or, you know, we didn't have much of that there.
Really? So you grew up in Whiteland?
Whiteland,
with your Aryan brethren?
No, it was an old citrus farming community.
Okay, all right, take it easy. Don't freak out, Grapes of Wrath guy.
Yeah.
Populist, I get it. I understand what you're saying.
The Wolfpack, go Wolfpack.
Okay, buddy.
Claremont High School.
Now you're over my head.
Woo!
Highland Hornets, screw you, man.
Highland Hornets?
Yeah, Highland Hornets. Highland High School, Albuquerque, New Mexico. You know who went to Albuquerque High?
No, who?
That guy who writes Beavis and Butthead.
Yeah, you know who went to Claremont High?
Who?
The guy who was in Blue Lagoon with...
Who was that?
With What's-Her-Face.
All right, good deal.
That was his only shot of stardom there.
You know what's hilarious is that neither one of us know the names of who were... How come I can't think? It's not... Matt Drudge keeps coming up in my head, but it's not... What's the guy's name who wrote... Matt Judge. Mike Judge. Mm-hmm. He's much better than Matt Drudge. Though I do use the Drudge Report as a resource because occasionally you find news there that you're not going to find in other places. Not that I'm plugging it, but hey, kids, we're going to do the short order news in a minute. I'm trying to postpone this as long as possible because I know this may be preempted by women's basketball.
Yeah.
And certainly I don't want to, I want to try and accommodate the women and their balls because I think it's important to some people. And, I'm all for women's basketball. I'm just having a hard time that right now it's on instead of me, except for people listening tomorrow. You dig what I'm saying, Jimmy?
I hear you.
Ah, Jimmy! Hey, Jimmy! Let me tell you what's on the rest of the show. Hal Buell, photo editor at the Associated Press for 40 years. He was head of their international photo service for 25 years. He's got a new book called Uncommon Valor, Common Virtue. It's Iwo Jima and the photograph that captured America. It is basically a history of that photograph, that famous photograph of them planting that flag on that mountain.
Now, is he a photographer himself?
No, I believe he is a photo editor. Okay. I imagine he's probably a photographer, but I don't think that's part of his credits. I think he is a chooser of photographs for the consumption of the masses in terms of their news product. You dig, man? So let me get back around to this. Can't get back around to this thing. This box of chocolates we got from China that I was talking about yesterday from King Kong, I did not go into it because I didn't realize what it was. These are literally, here's a box called Play Choco, and these are chocolate shaped, these are condoms. They're shaped like condoms. They look like the little ring of a condom with white chocolate as the ring, and on the inside it's got the little reservoir tip. They're modeled after condoms. Not sure what the appeal is. I didn't know anyone ever thought of like, man, I wish I could eat these. Don't you wish you could eat these? They come in a little package like candy. I wish I could eat a condom. But even more disturbing.
They aren't used, are they?
Oh, come on, Jim. They'd be a different shape. They'd all be all droopy, and they'd have to make them out of gummy or something.
Have some nice cream in there. Okay, let's get going to the next one.
Who did that?
I didn't do that.
You just did that.
Oh, give me a break. I
just came off the improv stage.
I didn't make spooge jokes about candy.
I am a topical humorist. I don't make condom jokes.
You didn't make a condom joke.
Cream in them.
Yeah, you made a goo joke. Don't try and.
Hey, man, I speak to the people.
No, you don't.
You've lost touch with the people. That's your problem.
Now, here's the other disturbing one. This is Sophie. This is what's the name of the candy. And I believe these are modeled after feminine napkins. Is that possible? Don't you get the idea that's what that is? Look right there.
I won't know until I get a taste.
Yeah? Why don't you say, hey, I prefer, do they have any that are used with some, maybe a cherry filling? Where's that joke?
Man,
I'm the bad guy
Bring
now.
Bring it down to your level now.
I'm the bad guy.
Oh, man.
I've had it with you today, man. I'm going to see if these are marshmallows. See, you got all mad at me because you made a comment about the improv like you didn't know what it was.
How are they?
These are awful.
You have cotton mouth?
No, dude,
No.
These are horrible. Taste one.
Oh, yeah.
These are horrible.
These are horrible. Have one. No, I'm not going to have one you say they're horrible.
No, they taste like what they smell like.
No.
When they're unused, like that weird scentedness that they put on those things. Come on, you never smelled your girlfriend?
Toss one over.
All right, while you taste that, we'll come back with the short order news. Let's have some music, Laughing Andy.
His latest tape is authentic. Mark Maron.
Hey, dude, I'm sorry you didn't make it as a stand-up. But you can't blame it on me or take it out on me.
I made it as a stand-up for 10 years.
What does that even mean?
I've made a living off and on. Well, you know, there are better years than most. For 10 years, I was in a duo, a team. We had to make twice as much money as a singular act.
Man.
You know what that means?
Joey Victim. Yeah.
Yeah, well, Joey Victim. I'm just telling you the truth. Fella. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know,
we
didn't get to make it by sleeping on people's couches because we were only two people. We were just one.
You need to
like
sleep in people's beds. You're like, hey, sorry, thanks for letting us stay at your house. Could you sleep on the couch?
We each had to have a car.
Barry and Jim and I have to. We
had to feed two mouths, not just one.
You know what I'm doing?
You know?
I'm playing my little violin.
Hey. You know what? We had to pay attention to another person on stage, which is twice as hard as going on, you know, rambling on and on about I, me, mine, my problems
I know,
on stage.
That's
blah,
a sad
blah,
story.
Blah, dee, dah, dah, dah.
Sad story, Jim. Hey, sorry about that first segment, people. Really, it was disgusting, and I'm embarrassed. But I do want to say this. We got a great show coming up here on June 3rd in the Los Angeles area, Laughing Liberally. You can go to KTLK.com for tickets. It's going to be me, Rick Overton, Will Durst, Jim David, Dean Obadala, and Katie Halper. It's going to be a great show. It's going to be down here at the Wadsworth Theater in Westwood, and we invite you all to come down June 3rd. How do you like that? Doing a little plug here on Progressive Talk, AM 1150 in Los Angeles. And also I wanted to say that chocolate, the reason I brought up the chocolate condoms at all, Jim, at all, Denny Hastert going down. Just add him to the list. Add him to the list.
You really think he's going to go down, huh?
They're all going down, dude. The jig is up, my friend. It's up. It was the Justice Department punishing him. Dude, come on. All right. Chocolate. All right. Chocolate, good for brain function. Stimulants. Theobromine, phenethylamine, and caffeine. Bang, bang. In the head, make you think better, Jim. That's why you're so damn sharp and quick.
Dark chocolate, right? The darker the better, right?
Sure. Sure. You're a great example.
That's why the Dutch are so smart and fun-loving.
Hey, folks, I don't want you to be caught off guard today or uninformed. So we've got the first edition here of the Mark Maron Show Short Order News. Kenneth Lay and Jeffrey Skilling were convicted today of conspiracy to commit securities and wire fraud in one of the biggest business scandals in U.S. history. Both men are now planning another scandal in prison that could cost inmates up to 60 billion cigarettes. Laughing Andy, just chuckling there. Not full-on laugh. House Republicans and Democratic leaders are jointly demanding the FBI return documents taken in a Capitol Hill raid on Representative William Jefferson's office. This is a rare show of election year unity for members of both parties who say that if the FBI can just come in and search your office, maybe someday people's home phones will be randomly tapped without a search warrant. Houston, Texas rates first in the nation for the number of postal employees bitten by dogs, with Orange County, California coming in second. 108 mail carriers were bitten in Houston last year, with 94 in Orange County and 83 in Indianapolis, proving conclusively that the meanest dogs are bred by conservatives. Not so much a joke per se, but an astute thought. What?
You hit it. You hit the nail right on the head there.
That is the short order news for today. I didn't bring that up, and I should have, but we got into talking about chocolate condoms. But, my friends, by the way, Dean Baker, economist and author, who I hope, again, will treat me like a moron so we can all understand what the hell he's trying to say. Skilling and Lay, Kenneth Lay, Jeffrey Skilling, were convicted of many things. On all six counts, Enron founder Kenneth Lay, all six counts that were against him. Why am I saying that like that? It's a... Skilling was convicted on 19 of the 28 counts against him. These counts are all about false statements, and why can't I just say what the verdicts... They were bad guys, and they could face 45 years in prison for Lay and 185 for the Skilling.
They got nailed.
Thank God. But are the people going to get their money back? No. There's a lot of charges. I'll tell you what they are in a second.
Bring him the head of Alfredo Garcia, Mark Maron.
Conspiracy, securities, and wire fraud is what they were guilty of, the two-isms. Kenny Boy Lay and Jeff Skilling. 45 years for the corporate crimes against Lay if he is sent to the big house, and he's facing 120 years for some personal bank fraud that he pulled off.
But he won't go to the big, he's going to go to the nicer house, so... white collar crime. Right?
Yeah, I feel that they should be hung publicly, or they should be forced to pay back the people they bilked. I mean, the collapse alone, it took $60 billion in market value. It took $2.1 billion in pension plans. $2.1 billion down the crapper in pension plans of people that believed in this company. 5,600 jobs. Any amount of prison is not enough. And I think we can address that a bit with our guest. When talking about the evils of the GOP and the future of this country, the ones that have the real answers, the truth, are sometimes the most misunderstood, by me anyways. When I try to wrap my head around economics, my eyes glaze over and I lapse into a hard homework nap. Dean Baker has written a book that is actually available online for download. It's called The Conservative Nanny State. From what I gleaned from reading Before My Eyes Glazed Over, there is truth within here. And here to explain a few of those truths is Dean Baker. Thanks for joining us, Dean.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Yeah, you got to talk to me like I'm a moron about this stuff. Could you, please?
I don't think they'll be necessary, but I think I can make things pretty simple. First off, you just mentioned that it was available for download. Let me point out it's available for free download. We're circulating as a free ebook, although people can buy paperback copies.
I absolutely recommend it. I have both copies, and I'm having a hard time, sort of understanding it. What is the nanny state? Explain that to us first.
Well, let me give the title of the book, which I think goes a long way. It's called The Conservative Nanny State.
Yes.
How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. Now,
okay.
The nanny state, I don't know how much the term's used outside the Beltway, but here it's sort of a pejorative term for those of us who like things like Social Security, Medicare, government programs that we think of as helping out the bulk of the population,
right,
people through their lives. That's often referred to by conservatives, Republicans, as the nanny state. And the point of the book is to say, the Republicans like to say, look, we're tough individualists. We'll take the lumps. We're up against the market. If we win, we want to come out ahead. And if you lose, too bad. We'll give you some crumbs maybe. But my point is, in writing this book, the conservative nanny state, is that they're out there. They want the government every bit as much as any liberal progressive. They want the government, but they don't want the government to give money to the bulk of the population. They want the government to make people rich.
Right.
Make them rich, I should say. Make
right.
them rich.
So that means
they've tilted the rules so that they will come out ahead.
So it also means that, and this is the party that claims to be about small government and against government intervention, yet this government, this particular administration, is overseeing one of the largest expansions of government ever, and most of that expansion is to protect and nurture corporate interests, not individual interests, but you're also saying that along with those corporate interests, people of a certain type of tax bracket, a certain type of employment, right?
Well, yes, but I'm not just talking about taxes, because we see that. That's in the paper. We know about that. They gave tax breaks to wealthy people. We know that.
But legislation as well. Yeah, right.
But let me go behind that, because let's start, we have a lot of auto workers in the country have lost their jobs, have been forced to take big pay cuts, are giving up their health care benefits, their pensions. Why is that? Because we're told auto workers can't compete in the world economy. Well, why can't they compete in the world economy? Because we have trade agreements like NAFTA, CAFTA, we've arrangements with China, go down the list, which have been designed to put our U.S. auto workers in direct competition with auto workers in Mexico, China, and other countries where they get paid much, much less than workers here.
Right.
Okay, auto workers here have a hell of a time competing. That's right. How come our doctors aren't in competition? Well, we don't let foreign doctors just come in the country, set up shop, and compete with, the doctors here.
Right.
So we have radiologists that get $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 a year because they do not compete in the world market.
Okay, so that's how the difference in wage occurs. Now, in terms of how these trade agreements work and what they do for American workers, now you're talking in the book, as I understand it, is that they pass legislation that will stifle the workers' ability to fight for a higher wage, that will stifle the individual's ability to take legal action against corporations, that the way that the conservatives use government is primarily to almost always screw the underclass worker in this culture.
Well, exactly, except I wouldn't say underclass worker, it's the bulk of the workers.
Period.
So trade is a real obvious example. Certainly the rules on union organizing have made it very, very difficult for unions to organize. They make it very difficult for them to strike so that, for example, a common mechanism that workers used to have, striking workers used to have, is they'd support each other picket lines. So, if you have the restaurant workers striking in a particular restaurant and the Teamsters truck drivers come up, see there's a strike, a picket line, they go, well, we're not going to, we support the restaurant workers. Well, they get arrested for that now.
Right.
So they call the government and say, arrest these guys. They're going to hurt the profits of the restaurant.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the immigration issue and in terms of how you're portraying and understanding the economy. What is the right thing to do here?
Well, immigration, we sometimes have it, people talking about it being an open border. What we have is, in effect, a die-in-the-border policy that, if you're willing to take the risk of coming across the border, working off the books, you could be deported any time, you break a, traffic law, you could be sent back to, wherever you had come from, lose everything, you can come up here. Now, for, people in dire straits in Mexico and other developing countries, they're willing to take that risk. But you aren't going to have doctors, lawyers, economists, accountants. You aren't going to have higher-income people coming across the border and competing with our professionals under those terms. So what we've done is, again, we've put the less educated, less skilled workers in direct competition with people from developing countries. So what I would say is, if we want a fair immigration policy, one is we're not keeping people at the border. That's just ridiculous. We're making it risky for them. But we should figure out how many immigrants we want here, let them come here legally, And don't skew it so they compete with people at the bottom. If we think we need immigrants, we could save an awful lot of money. We'd all pay a lot less for our health care if we brought in immigrant doctors who educate to U.S. standards. We want them at the same standards, who would bring down the price of health care in our country. If we paid the same price for our doctors as they did in Europe, it would save us $80 billion a year. Imagine that, $80 billion a year, just from paying the same price for our doctors as they do in Europe.
Well, don't you think the doctors would resist that? And isn't a lot of the health care costs jacked up by investments on behalf of insurance corporations?
Well, the doctors would resist it. The question is, you know, why do they get to set their wages, but auto workers don't, restaurant workers don't, the doctors don't want to get lower pay, but the rest, that's out of our pockets. Now, yeah, I'd certainly, the health insurance is another story, a very big story, that, you know, about 25-30% of our health care expenditures go to pay for costs associated with the system of insurance we have. If we had a system like, you know, what you had in Canada, what you have in Europe, we would save, you know, on the order of about $200 billion a year in administrative fees, fees that are just, you know, profits or money paid to shuffle papers back and forth between, you know, the bureaucrats and the insurance companies. And important to point out, people want to trash those systems. People live longer in Canada. They live longer in Europe than they do in the United States. So we're paying a lot of money, and it's not clear what we're getting for it.
Absolutely. And I think it would make for a much healthier mentally, a much healthier population. And I find it disturbing that everybody in this country, because there's no health care, because they are no longer able to declare personal bankruptcy, because they aren't able to seek justice in an appropriate fashion against maybe corporations that can harm them, is that everybody is really just, you know, one work injury, you know, one divorce, one illness away from being completely broken without any ability to help themselves.
Absolutely. I mean, the degree of insecurity that we have today, I mean, it's so much greater than was the case, you know, 20, 30 years ago when I was growing up. And you go, have we gotten poorer? You know, is our technology worse today? You know, when we have the internet and computers and all this great technology, you know, why is it that we can't have the same security for a population that we just took for granted 30 years ago, or at least many of us, middle-income people certainly were able to take for granted. I don't want to say it was a golden age, but, you know, for certainly someone with a normal middle-class job, they were far more secure 30 years ago than they are today.
Right. Well, our guest is Dean Baker. The book is The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Used the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. Now, if you could explain something to me that I found interesting and don't quite understand, how does the Fed, the Federal Reserve Bank, control employment, and why would they want less people to be working?
Well, again, it's a really, really important story that very, very few people really follow or really understand. Everyone knew about Alan Greenspan, thought he was a great guy and everything. Well, part of the story, what the Fed does, it's their job or one of their jobs to control inflation. Now, how do they control inflation? Well, when Alan Greenspan thought that inflation might be getting too high, or today Benjamin Bernanke, the new chair of the Fed, they think inflation is getting too high, they raise interest rates. And we hear this talked about like, you know, we're cooking a stew. We don't want the economy to overheat. Well, what does that literally do? Well, you're raising interest rates because you want to slow the economy. You want to reduce car buying, home buying, other things that depend on interest rates. When that happens, fewer people are employed. You might even push people out of work. And the reason for doing that is, when you get a lot of people out of work, well, those who are still working have a harder time pushing for higher wages. You know, if you ask your boss for a pay increase and then go out and hire someone else the same day, they're going to tell you to get lost.
Right.
They know that. So this is exactly the point. And it's not because they're evil people, but that's their tool for controlling inflation. And, of course, it's not, I'm an economist. I'm not going to lose my job when Ben Bernanke or Alan Greenspan raises the interest rates. The CEO, he's not going to lose his job. People lose their job are the auto workers, you know, the retail sales clerks, the dishwashers, people at the middle and bottom.
Right.
So what we're doing is we're throwing them out of work, putting downward pressure on their wages in order to control inflation.
So, okay, now let's get to the how do we fix it part, Dean Baker.
Well, what we have to do is first understand it. We have to understand all the various ways in which they're rigging the deck. Trade agreements that put downward pressure on wages of middle-income, lower-income workers, the Federal Reserve Board. There are other ways to try and deal with inflation. In Europe, they have other mechanisms. I can go through the history on that. Patents on prescription drugs pushes the prices through the roof. We could have a better health care system. Every other country in the world has national health care insurance, or every other rich country. So there's a range of options. There's not a single one. But the first and most important thing is people have to understand this isn't an accident that, you know, it just we rolled the dice and most people ended up losers and Bill Gates and Ken Lay and these other people ended up as big winners. They rigged the deck. We have to understand that. They don't want the market. They want the hand of the government in there to rig the deck so they get richer.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And I'm gonna study your book. I might call you back in a month or so.
Give the website conservativenannystate.org. Free download. If you want to buy the paperback, you can order it right there.
Thank you so much, Dean Baker.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
You take care.
You too.
You can also link to that on markmaron.com. I think I understand a little more. We've got a lot of work to do in just disassembling legislation that is there to protect rich people and corporations. I think Johnny K Street looks like he's coming in, so hang out for that.
Now, don't forget to use proper postage. Mark Maron.
Did you read about this weird movie? I tell you, I was listening to Dean Baker, and still I had to fight. Like I literally have this weird thing in myself. Like, listen, in class, like math class, where I was just like, oh.
That? You think that's important? What about, you know, he on his blog, he talked about American Idol and how the voting mechanism is flawed.
Yeah. That's important, too.
It is.
I'd need to.
It's a microcosm for the for our voting system.
Our voting system's completely flawed. I wonder what's going to happen in the midterms.
Yeah, but people believe in the American Idol voting system, you see.
Do they really?
Yes, they do.
Do they really?
Why else would they have like 60, how
people
many
people vote twice. I mean, people vote three times. They have their friends vote. It's ridiculous. I don't even want to get involved with it. This is more interesting to me. Cate Blanchett.
So out of touch. But go ahead.
That's fine. If I'm out of touch with that, you know, I saw the guy who won. Good for him. I wish him all the luck. If only he could be as popular and as successful as that guy Stoddard. What's his name?
Reuben Stoddard?
Yeah. All right. Look, Cate Blanchett is going to play Bob Dylan in part. She's one of six actors who's going to play Bob Dylan in this weird new biopic by Todd Haynes, who's a genius.
I hope she loses some weight.
Todd Haynes is a genius.
Yeah?
Yeah. Did you see A Velvet Goldmine? He did, and he did the other one, Safe. That movie is a masterpiece. I don't even understand it. But because he's so committed to it, and it is so long, and so peculiar, and bizarre, and deals with, so intimately with Julianne Moore and that weird allergy. And of course, he did the Karen Carpenter story with Barbie dolls, which you can't get because it's illegal. I have a copy of it on video.
It's illegal?
It's illegal because he used the songs. It's great.
Oh,
it goes into her with the epicac.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that. Yeah,
yeah, it's great. It's I'm looking forward to this now. This is a movie I'm excited about because it sounds weird. Richard Gere is also going to play Dylan in one of the phases. Cate Blanchett's going to play him. What's the guy? Heath Ledger. It sounds like a bizarre, bizarre film. So, folks, there's a lot of big stories in the news this week, so let's get some bets down with our own Inside the Beltway odds maker, Johnny K Street. Johnny, where's the action, man?
Follows me, baby.
Yeah.
I sent you a couple of messages this week, Mark. I don't know if you got them or not. If you didn't, just check with Michael Hayden. You know, in a way, I feel sorry for the guys in the NSA that have to listen to all those idiotic conversations people have night and day, you know?
Yeah.
Especially in Los Angeles. How many times can you hear, I would have been perfect for that part. I need to get new headshots. Or I wonder if I should get implants before you want to kill yourself.
Exactly. Yeah.
The NSA agents in L.A. aren't even allowed to carry guns. It's too dangerous for them.
Right. Hey, man, do you have any action on Hayden, Johnny?
First of all, why do so many people who work for Bush look like fat little babies in suits or uniforms?
Right.
Like Karl Rove and Hayden.
Yeah.
You don't know whether to salute Hayden or give him a cookie.
Right.
They all have that bald, wrinkled look like Eisenhower without the integrity.
Exactly.
Bush is in the process of turning over the government to the military, plus he's listening to all our conversations, reading all our email, and he wants a national ID card. I'll give you 50-1 Halliburton is building the camps right now. The only thing missing is the Charlie Chaplin mustache and the swastika. And no one is trying to stop him.
Wow.
You know, once you're tattooed and on the train, it's a little too late to start talking impeachment. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
Hayden will become the new head of the CIA, and I'm giving even money on it, baby.
All right, well, I'll take that bet for $5. Hey, have you checked your phones?
I've got more taps than Savion Glover's closet. Yeah, all that surveillance is really paying off for them.
Did you say Savion Glover?
Maybe. The NSA can track anyone through a computer except for Osama bin Laden. This guy's been downloaded more than Jenna Jameson, and we still can't find him. I'm giving 1,000-1 we actually catch a terrorist, any terrorist, by the end of the year.
All right, then. Well, that sounds like a lock to me. Put me down for 200.
You are down! I'm staying away from the computer, though, Mark. I'll tell you, I've gone back to using betting slips for a while.
Yeah, I was wondering what you were holding there, Johnny.
By the way, these slips are made of recycled paper, Air America listeners. It's all about the environment, baby.
Wow, that's beautiful, Johnny. I didn't realize you were so environmentally conscious.
Oh, yeah. My place in Vegas is solar-powered. That's a great thing about living in the desert. Lots of sun and constant action.
Yeah.
These slips are a gift from Al Gore. He's been a friend since the 2002 election, you know.
Oh, yeah?
Well, I had Bush stealing it at 40-1. Gore bet huge and cleaned up. You didn't hear him complaining about it, did you, when he lost? It's all in my book, You Bet My Life, the Johnny K Street story, coming soon to Broadway. But we'll talk about that next time. I'm still in negotiations.
Oh, well, that's great. I wish you the best of luck with that. What kind of action do you have on the possible Karl Rove indictment, Johnny? Is it looking like a sure thing or what?
There are no sure things with this White House. Let's put it this way. If Bush owned the casino and you hit 21 playing blackjack, he changed the rules to 22. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I'm giving even money, Rove will be indicted. And in my humble opinion, this bet couldn't be more of a gift if I wrapped it and included a card.
All right. Okay, well then put me down for 1,000 scoots there, Johnny.
Beautiful. This is actually a two-part bet. Karl Rove is guilty. I know it. You know it. His lawyer knows it. But I'm giving 500 to 1 that the only pair of handcuffs Karl Rove will ever wear are the ones he uses when he plays sadistic jail guard and new inmate with Jeff Gannon once a week.
As disturbing as that image is, my friend, double me up. Let's talk about the wall that Bush is talking about building along the entire length of the Mexican border. What kind of odds do you have on that actually happening?
Yeah, no one has ever climbed a wall before. All right. If you're willing to walk across a desert in 100-degree heat for days with nothing but a gallon of water, or get jammed into a tractor trailer with 30 other people and driven through the desert in 100-degree heat, just so you can be first in line for a job washing dishes at Denny's, a wall isn't going to stop you.
Right. Yeah.
George Bush is talking about building a wall thousands of miles long, and this is a guy who couldn't fix 3 miles of levees. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The border wall, like the president, will never be erect, and that's even money.
Oh.
I'm out of here. I'm doing a walk-on in the new Lindsay Lohan project. She's into me for about 100 large. Sweet kid. She's good for it.
All right, Johnny, thanks for coming by. Always good to see Johnny K Street leaving with his bling on there. Man, I tell you, buddy, I can't, no mentioning names here.
What?
But I got into an email war with some guy over that South Park thing. Don't mention his name. He's threatened to sue.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He's got mad at me, man. He got mad at me because he said I got personal with my argument because I didn't agree with him. Just freaked out. It's amazing how you got a person who likes the show, decent guy. I disagree with him. He accuses me of slandering him and then literally is now threatening legal action. Legal action over what? Don't write a radio show if you don't want it to be talked about on the air. Yeah. I will not stop watching South Park. What can I tell you? I think it's funny. And I have reasons.
You're going to hear from my people.
Yeah? Man,
sorry,
you too,
man.
Huh?
Yeah, I got to make an extra buck.
He's mad at you, too. He was mad at you because you made fun of his name. So look out. He's going to send his legal team after you. Don't mention his name, though. We'll be back in a minute.
And now, what do you mean you can't send beer through the mail? Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
Nice to see you. It was a long break.
Yeah.
Yeah. Folks, Joe Rosenthal's photo of the five Marines planting the flag at Iwo Jima during the bloodiest battle in Marine Corps history is one of the most memorable photographs ever. It has appeared on stamps. It is a statue in Washington. It has come to represent, among other things, the American struggle and perseverance to win the Second World War. And if you're like me, you know very little about that battle. Hal Buell was a photo editor at the Associated Press for 40 years. He was head of their international photo service for 25 of those years. His new book, Uncommon Valor, Common Virtue, Iwo Jima and the Photograph That Captured America, is all about the battle and the photo. He's on the phone with us now. Welcome to the show, Hal Buell.
How are you?
I'm great. Obviously, this photo is an amazing example of photojournalism that has become a symbol for America in a lot of ways. In general, from your experience, what image components do you look for that define a great piece of photojournalism?
Well, the great icons of photojournalism history have something in common. First of all, they're very simple pictures, as this one is. Their message is transmitted instantly. They tend to capture a major event that was a turning point in history.
Mm-hmm.
And there is usually a history that comes before the picture and a history that comes after the picture, and somehow the before and the after is measured in the picture itself.
Now, out of all the photos you've seen, obviously this one has a tremendous amount of cultural momentum and importance. But what made you decide to write a book about the picture?
Well, Joe's 95 years old, so that's
the guy
one reason.
Okay.
The picture has a history that of many people trying to trivialize it. Sometimes calling it an accident, sometimes saying that it didn't reflect what it did reflect. And over the years, I've just been involved with news photography and this picture particularly, and I just felt that now was the time, that I'd fooled around with the picture for all these years and collected a lot of memorabilia about the picture, a lot of facts, talked with Joe many times about it, and decided that this was the time to do it. I like to get it out there while Joe can still see it.
Well, it's a beautiful book, and it comes with a DVD with a little history on it as well. And this is history that I got to admit, I am not a student of history as much as I should be. You want to tell us a little bit about this battle? I had no idea that it still is the bloodiest battle the Marines ever fought.
Well, it is. 6,000, almost 7,000 Marines died on Iwo Jima. There were 27 Medals of Honor awarded, which was one-third of all the Marine Medals of Honor in World War II. It was a critical battle because it was one of the final steps on the road to Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, when the battle was fought, no one knew that there was such a thing as the atomic bomb, and the battle foretold of a more serious battle that would come when the main islands of Japan were invaded. Iwo Jima actually was the first of the Japanese home islands to be invaded. Japan, in its 2,000 years of history, had never had a foreign invader. Iwo Jima actually is part of Tokyo. And so when the Marines landed there, it was the first time in history that happened.
No.
It also made a base for fighter planes that gave protection to the bombers that were going over Tokyo from Saipan. The fighter planes couldn't make the round trip, and so they would, with the base at Iwo Jima, they were able to join fighters.
It's interesting, too, that this really represents a different time in the American military and the way American is seen and acts in the world militarily.
Well, of course, Americans were saviors in World War II, but, you know, at the time, the remarkable thing about this picture
mm-hmm.
is that at the time the picture came about, believe it or not, Americans were pretty fed up with the war, and particularly with the war in the Pacific. The war in Europe was going along on schedule. Americans understood the war in Europe. There were places like Berlin and Rome and Paris, London, you know, names that were part of our history and our own heritage. Whereas in the Pacific, we were dealing with battlefields called Eniwetok and
mm-hmm.
Saipan and Truk. And then Iwo Jima comes along, and the casualties on all those islands were remarkably high. And Americans were saying, hey, what's going on out there? We're losing a lot of people. When's this going to end? And yet in front of us is still Japan. If it's been this bad so far, what's it going to be like in the future? And then along came this picture, and it said all the things Americans needed to hear. It said valor, it said courage, it said victory. It said all our boys doing their job, and it stated the American sense of its own mission at mid-century.
Is there some way, though, it's interesting to me, Hal Buell, that this photo grew a life of its own, but it was sort of used, you know, by a number of different factions as sort of a propaganda tool, no?
Well, you know, many presidents have given talks in front of the monument
mm-hmm.
in Arlington, and yes, a lot of people wanted to ride the pure message of the picture for sometimes purposes that all of us don't appreciate.
And the truth of the matter is, when the picture was taken, it was midway through the battle. They didn't even know if they were going to win, did they?
No, they didn't. They had their eye on victory, but you're right about one thing. The picture took place on the fifth day of the battle, and the battle lasted 31 days. So Yes, you're exactly right. The battle had a long way to go, and there were a lot of Marines died and were wounded before it was finished.
Yeah, as I said, we're talking to Hal Buell. He is a former AP photo editor-in-chief over there at Associated Press. The book is called Uncommon Valor, Common Virtue, Iwo Jima and the Photograph That Captured America. Beautiful coffee table book with pictures and a DVD in it. Now let's talk about the current state of photojournalism as a guy who has looked at pictures, you know, most of your working life. Our images are still the most important way of documenting and communicating an event, and I don't imagine that will ever change. Is there an issue about the integrity of images now with computers and everything else? Is it harder to find images, and is it harder for them to resonate like they used to?
Well, the images still resonate. I mean, you know, you think back to Vietnam, which wasn't all that long ago, and what we remember of Vietnam is great. It's a great deal. Is measured in a great deal by the pictures that came out of there,
mm-hmm.
and that's likewise the case in Iraq. Pictures stick in the mind. Our memories work in still pictures, and so I don't think that there's any change in the value of pictures. I think that a lot of people who are aware that digital photography opens up the doors to false pictures. I think that's a growing concept, but you know, you have to rely on the ethics of the journalists who make these pictures.
Oh man. Boy!
And there's nothing new about falsifying pictures. Pictures
sure.
have been falsified. I mean, there were pictures falsified within a couple of years after photography was invented.
Right.
I could tell you a million stories about that.
Well, there was some issue about this one. It wasn't there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes,
well,
there
you,
was.
You
see,
talk about that in the book, don't you?
You know, it's part of the story, and it's part of the fascination of the story. There was a flag put up before the one that Joe photographed,
mm-hmm.
and that was the first flag that was made by a Marine photographer. And a commander down the beach said, "No, we want a larger flag put up there." And so they walked up a larger flag, and that's when Joe was on the top of the mountain, and he made the picture of the second flag going up. And there's a funny story about that.
Mm-hmm.
When Joe went to Guam on March 8th, which is more or less 10 days after he made the picture, somebody said, "Gee, Joe, that was a great picture you made." Well, Rosenau hadn't seen the picture. He still hadn't seen the picture.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, well, you know, the clips, tear sheets, that kind of thing didn't come back to Iwo Jima. And they said, "Geez, Joe, did you pose that?" Well, Joe had made a second picture of a bunch of Marines standing beneath the flag, waving their helmets and their guns, and he knew he made that picture. He wasn't so sure that he made the flag picture because it happened all of a sudden, and that's another story. But he said, "Yeah, I posed it." And then somebody a few minutes later brought up the flag picture, the raising picture, and he said, "Oh, I didn't pose that one. I posed this one." From then on, it was a story that just lasted 60 years.
Oh, I tell you, imagine if there were blogs around then.
Wow.
It'd be never-ending conflict.
It continues today, but you're right. If they had blogs then, there'd be still more controversy.
Yeah, well, you know, you're talking about Joe Rosenthal. He's a photographer, and not all those guys survived, did they?
Oh, no, there were photographers that died in the war, just like there were photographers that died in Vietnam, and photographers have died in the Middle
but
East. In
the soldiers, though, in the photograph, I mean, three of them made it back.
Oh, the flag raisers,
yeah.
You mean. Three of them died. You know,
no, three of them died.
And one was seriously wounded. You know, of the 40-man platoon that carried that took the top of Suribachi and put the flag up, only four walked off that island unhurt. The rest were killed or wounded.
Well, thanks so much for your book and your time, Hal Buell. And you take care of yourself. It's a beautiful
book. Mark, nice to talk to you.
All right, take care. Thank you.
Take care now.
Mm-hmm. That was Hal Buell. The book is Uncommon Valor, Common Virtue, Iwo Jima, and the Photograph That Captured America. We'll be back with a couple of the guys from Il Nino, the Latino metal band. Christian and Laz are going to be here, so hang out.
Teenagers love coal. Mark Maron.
Thanks, man. Man, what a day. What a day. Hastert going down. ABC breaks the news that he might be involved.
Enron.
That too. ABC breaks the news. He might be involved. Hastert says, "Well, this is the executive branch. This is the Justice Department trying to teach me a lesson for calling them on their crap for their trespass." And then ABC sticks by the story. Hastert says, "Well, I'm going to sue you for libel," and that's where it stands. He may not be guilty, but he's certainly acting like it. Cheney is going to be called in by Patrick Fitzgerald to stand witness. Fitzgerald said he would be a logical government witness because he could authenticate notes that he jotted down on July 6th. Basically, this is what, Brett, I tell you, Fitzgerald got huge nads, man. Big nads. He's talking about Libby, Louis Libby. Fitzgerald says, Libby shared the interests of his superior and was subject to his direction. Therefore, the state of mind of the vice president as communicated to defendant is directly relevant to the issue of whether defendant knowingly made false statements to federal agents and the grand jury regarding when and how he learned about Plame's employment and what he said to reporters regarding this issue. End quote. He's going to make the vice president, the most powerful man in the world, sit there like a bitch and take this investigation. What a beautiful guy this guy is. Reminds me of that Jack Nicholson movie, A Few Good Men. That moment where Cruz pushes him over the edge, and inarguably the only movie that Cruz actually, you know, rose to the occasion as an actor. Jim, bad news for you.
What?
And your causes, what do I say that for? It's a horrible thing all around. What? The House of Representatives today voted to approve a plan to allow drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife
Preserve. But very slim chance it'll pass in the Senate.
In the Senate. That's absolutely right. Yeah. But the way these guys are politicizing it, though, which is nauseating, is that Republicans are playing to their constituents saying, hey,
we need oil. We need gas.
What are we going to do? You want to pay that much money at the pump? And people are willing to say, the hell with those reindeer. Screw the beauty of the world.
You know, I think the constituents in middle America who are starving, have their farms are going down the tubes, are going to look at all that corn that they can't sell and say, well, why the hell are we going to drill in Alaska when we can sell corn?
I hope to God you're right. I hope that, you know, because I am sickened by people who are willing to sacrifice the Arctic National Wildlife Preserve just because their gas is too expensive. I'm sickened that those kind of people live in this country and think in that way without first saying, hey, why'd they shut down the electric car? Why can't we use it? Why can't we feed our cars grass? Like, they're making a grazing car that literally runs on grass. Am I right? On weeds? Or why can't we run it on corn? Why can't we turn the car on and feed it some corn?
We're still going to buy an old Mercedes that runs on grease.
I'm all for that, Jim. I was busting your butt about it before, but not anymore. Hey, look, we got a call here. Brian from Albany is on the line. Hey, Brian, you're on the air with Mark Maron.
Hey, Mark. It's actually John Zach, the NSA guy, has been tapping your phone. You know how I kind of do comedy myself?
Yes, yes, you told me.
Well, not like you. I mean, I got a long way to go. But I went ahead and contacted your booker for that gig Friday at UCB, and guess who's opening for you now?
What are you talking about?
I know, it's great. Oh. We can hang out at the club, then I can listen to your calls back at the hotel. By the way, that bit you were doing on the phone with David Cross about airport strip searches, can I use that?
What are you talking? That was something David and I came up with.
Yeah, but technically I was on the phone with you when you were coming up with it, so I think I own a piece of it. Hello?
I'm done with that guy. I'm done with him. I'm just going to hang up on him every time.
I don't know why
creepy.
You take these calls. Either.
Because I can. All right, so Jim, do we have a thing? What is that? Do we have a thing? Yeah, we got the
environmental news.
Yeah, do we have an environmental news?
We got one. I think we're going to put it in the cart right now. And now it's time for this week's disturbing environmental news that'll frighten you, but not enough to really do anything about it. Brought to you by
Ortho Snail and Slug Pellets. Hi, I'm Mark Maron, and if you're like me, you like to keep a tidy backyard. And if you're really like me, you like to kill everything that comes within 6 feet of your garden. That's why I use Ortho Snail and Slug Pellets. Ortho Snail and Slug Pellets will keep your garden safe. And by safe, I mean free of any worldly imperfections. Just like it was in the Garden of Eden when Jesus first had sex with Judas, or whoever the hell that was. Anyway, scientists agree our cocktail of poison chemicals will keep working long after your marriage falls apart and you've stopped caring about that crappy clump of nasturtiums you planted for that bitch. In fact, it'll last for decades, slowly sinking into the soil, into water tables, and ultimately emptying onto your local beach. That's why you'll never see a banana slug in Malibu, unless Ernest Borgnine drops his swim trunks. But how can you tell it's working, you ask? Well, for one thing, your neighbor's dog will start twitching and foam will come out of his ear holes. Other companies might charge extra for that service, but not Ortho. And now, back to this week's disturbing environmental news.
Due to government inaction on overfishing, countless species of sea creatures face extinction. At least 100 tons of uncollected oil from the Exxon Valdez is still killing Alaskan wildlife. And as expected, today another 200,000 acres of rainforest were obliterated to help stuff your fat, obtuse faces with hamburgers and steaks. Eat well, barbarians. And that was this week's disturbing environmental news that'll frighten you, but not enough to really do anything about it. Brought to you by
Ortho Snail and Slug Pellets. Mmm. Tastes like kibble. That was an important service announcement.
You've been eating it. You can't. You're not supposed to eat that stuff.
I feel great. I know you're not supposed to. Certain things, though, I think make you stronger if you eat them.
I guess so. You develop an immunity.
Why am I engaged in a malicious, stupid email argument with a listener of the show? Why do I let myself? I haven't done that in a long time, and this guy's got my goat. You know, he's jerking me around.
Perhaps
and
we
I'm
can
in
get
it.
Him on the show.
I'm willing. Don't mention his name though, because he might sue us. We should have him on the show just to argue about South Park for a few minutes.
Good idea.
Hey, yeah, I know it's a little bad. All right, look, we'll be back with El Nino, I think. Maybe.
Now he's got the lizard flu. Mark Maron.
Hey, wait a minute. Hey, folks, listen to this. New Jersey's most famously produced Bruce Springsteen, but the state continues to churn out rock. If you hear that right now, it's not classic rock in terms of like Springsteen was, but it is certainly rock and roll. Do they still call it that? Someone criticized me that for calling it rock and roll still. In studio now to talk about their new album, One Nation Underground, from the Latino metal band El Nino. Is that right?
That is yes. Correct.
Oh, thank God. Lead vocalist Christian Machado.
Machado.
Machado. And bass player Las Pina.
Las Pina, baby.
Las Pina. Thanks for coming in, fellas.
Oh, thank you for having us, man.
You can still call it rock and roll. I'm not an old guy.
You know
for
what?
Saying.
It's all rock and roll, man. And I think that we should just go back and just refer to it as rock and roll. And that's
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Forget all the different
labels. Yeah, forget the new
labels.
Metal, neo metal, thrash metal.
Labels are for like the critics that want to sound cool, like they invented something. I invented a label.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. But how many Latino metal bands are there, though, actually?
None, actually.
You're
we're
it, right?
Actually the only one.
Are you now?
We're the brave ones, man, the brave souls.
See, a label suits this band, definitely. A new label suits this band.
Well, I live in a Latino neighborhood, like primarily Latino neighborhood, and I know that the Latino
you
kids
and
are
a million other people around
there. Yeah, LA's a Latino neighborhood.
LA, California.
But these kids, man, they love
actually,
metal.
LA stands for Latin America.
Yeah, that's right. But these kids love metal, man. I mean, when I was growing up, I grew up in New Mexico, and it was like cholo and disco. That was all there was. But I see the Latino kids now. It's all long hair. It's all metal. Is that new?
You know what it is, man? I think they're just trying to steal it from all the American people. They're like, you know what? We're here, and we're going to take your music, too.
I actually had this weird theory that just because of, like, there's a sort of Mexican history around Day of the Dead and all the skull imagery and then
right.
the history of wrestling
it's
in Mexico.
Yeah, it's only
theatrics.
Suitable.
Yeah, right?
Theatrics is a
big,
big part
of metal.
It.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you guys, where are your families from originally?
All over the place, man. My mom is from Uruguay,
uh-huh.
South America. My
yeah.
father's Brazilian. I have some European family. I'm kind of like the mutt of the band, if
oh,
you
yeah,
will.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
My family are from originally from the Dominican Republic. My mother's half Dominican, half Puerto Rican, and the rest Dominican. And we all make our home in New York City.
Oh, you're in New York
well,
City?
Well, I grew up in New York City. I was actually born and raised in New York City, but I'm a, what you call a pure Latino American.
Okay,
you know,
all right.
The original.
Yeah, I hear
I'm
you.
I'm a Latino born in America.
So I think this is actually the first metal album that has Latino percussion and Latino melody on it, is it not?
Most likely, possibly, yes. I mean,
there has been
other bands to do, you know, the bilingual thing before, but I don't think that other bands did it as universal as we try to do it. You know, we bring all sorts of Latin culture into the music, not just one particular Latin culture. It's not just tribal essences that we blend into it. It's not just flamenco essences. It's not just Caribbean. It's all universal Latin cultures, being that we're all from so many different Latin countries. I mean, after all, if you think about it, how many countries speak Spanish?
I know.
A lot of them.
Yeah, a lot.
Most of them.
and all the cultures are completely different, you know, if you start looking at all the cultures.
Yeah.
Everybody's got different cultures. But everybody likes rice and beans, though.
That's important. Rice and beans and variations on the plantain and a couple other things.
A fish
tortilla.
Taco every
corn.
Now and then. There you
corn.
Go.
Yeah, got to have the corn. So, okay, who are your influences, man? What did you grow up with?
Wow.
I mean, like, what?
Mine stem from, like, the Clash, the Ramones, to...
Yeah, Clash.
Oh, man. I love all kinds of music, man. I love jazz. I love metal. I love Ozzy, Sabbath. Man, it just goes on.
Oh, man, it's your MySpace page. Have you listed that all?
I got quite a few on there.
Yeah,
I listen to all types of music, man. Yeah. I think that good music is just good music. As long as it's original, as long as you bring something cool to the table and not just copy somebody over and over, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So but at heart, I'm a metalhead, and I also have a little bit of punk rock in my heart.
Well, I think there's like, they're sort of meeting. They're meeting right in the middle these days, aren't they?
Yeah. Absolutely. I grew up in New York. I mean, you know, the Ramones were a dear band to me, and like the New York hardcore bands like Agnostic Front and even bands like, you know, Talking Heads and Blondie, you know. I dig that too.
So this is like, metal's always been about like a rebellion, individuality, a dark truth. On this album, you guys talk about war and social injustice, God. Like, what are the most important issues to you? What do you want to get out there? Are you political when you perform? Do you talk?
I wouldn't say we're political. Socially aware, yes.
Yeah.
Political, no. You know, to just go around and pointing the finger and saying, well, it's the Republican Party or it's
right.
this guy. I don't think that it really changes the world. I think that speaking about reality, real things that are going on, perhaps in this situation where we have the immigration laws and everything like that, you know, I'd like to kind of flip it and say, well, you want to speak about immigration laws. I'd like to speak about why Walmart has their manufacturing plants overseas.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
We got Americans buying their products. They're making trillions of dollars off America, yet they don't hire American people.
Right.
So what is wrong with that?
Yeah.
Things like that.
Switch it on the people. Make them think about it.
Things like that is what I'd like to concentrate more on, you know, lyrically, from a lyrical point of view, is open your mind. Really just go... speak and look beyond the topics that are just being thrown in your face, because the reality is that the real topics are not the ones being discussed.
That's absolutely, I mean, that's what this whole network is built on, you know. It's like trying to raise awareness of the truth. And that's an amazing thing about a lot of metal. My wife's a big metalhead, and I didn't grow up with it necessarily, but it seems that, you know, people like Megadeth and people like Tool and the guys in System of a Down now, they're really trying to push through these truths, and they use the music just to, you know, plow it into your brain that you don't know what the hell is going on if you believe the crap.
Yeah, I think that metal and punk rock is
for
the rebels, you know?
Absolutely,
it really is,
man.
It's a no holes barred, you know, no BS. Just speak your mind and really tell people something that they haven't heard on TV all the time.
Absolutely.
So that's kind of like what I guess lyrically what we try to do is keep it smart, but keep it very interesting and new.
So now, what about, there's some spiritual elements on this record too? Is that true? With My Resurrection, is that a personal story?
I think that My Resurrection is just one of those songs that a lot of people think about the title and they say, okay, this is obviously a song about Christianity. But in reality, it is about my resurrection. If you say the words, my resurrection, you don't necessarily have to mean, you know, you're going to die and then when you
come
back to another life, you are going to be this cleansed person.
Right.
My Resurrection is really just about cleansing yourself in your current life.
Rebirth right of now. Consciousness.
Very much.
Got it. Yeah, it's a good thing about songs. It's like, I know I'm putting you in an awkward position. Like, could you explain that song to me? Yeah, could you tell me what that's about? A lot of times songs are just songs or poetry. Use it for what you want, right?
You like to leave it open for interpretation, but there is a bass to every song, though.
Yeah. Hey, you're the bass player.
I think Laz has like Laz has like the coolest interpretations for the songs. Like, he'll have... Laz, what is this song about? Well, one time I was walking down the street and I saw a piece of gum on the floor.
Well, you know what? I'm a firm believer. I mean, music is open for interpretation.
Sure.
I think great music. You know, someone tells a story and it means a lot to them, but it's interpreted differently. And in certain cases, it saves lives, you know?
Yeah.
We get all the time people coming up to us to say, wow, you know, your music just saved my life. And I'll say, really, well, what does the song mean to you? And they have their own interpretation about it, and that's cool.
Yeah, I can't deny them that.
The emotion is there, you know, and you know, they get the actual emotion.
Yeah.
And then they just interpret their own lives and apply it to it.
One of the funniest interpretations of a song coming from the artist to me was definitely Phil Collins' In the Air Tonight. I loved that song my entire life.
Yeah.
And then when I turned like 28, I found out that it was about him watching a guy drown, or him watching a guy that was watching a guy drown.
Right.
I said, man, you just killed it for me. You know? I mean, that song meant everything to me. It could have been about an ex-girlfriend. It could have been about this and that and that. But now I totally cannot relate with you, because I never saw a guy that was looking at a guy drown.
He killed it. He killed the song. Yeah, maybe you should say what the hell the song's really about. But like this song, the one we played, Come In, I think This Is War. Is that what we played?
Mm-hmm. I believe so, yeah.
Now, is that a reaction to what's going on in the world right now, or is it a different, again, I'm doing it, but wait, but since you have the interpretations, lay it on me.
Man, you know what, it's This Is War on a lot of things, not just, you know, society and our world today, but also the genre of music we're in, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, you know, you get stigmatized under a certain label, and, you know, you just... Hey, man.
Yeah.
Everybody's got to go for theirs now, man.
This is war. Okay, I get it. Yeah, this is about us. This is about us standing out.
That's right.
You've been on the road. Where were you? You're going to be, by the time this is on, you're going to probably be just coming out for your encore here in L.A. And where were you yesterday? Were you somewhere?
We were at the Soma in San Diego.
How was it?
Oh, it was terrific. Classic place.
Yeah.
Classic club.
A lot of people coming out.
The owner's miserable. It was a decent crowd. You know, San Diego's weird. Tonight's going to be pretty hot. So we had a pretty high presale. So
yeah, San Diego's weird.
San Diego is weird.
It is a little weird. Yeah,
I always get a weird vibe, but I love it there anyway.
It's pretty,
and the show was terrific. The fans were really, really warm last night.
And you're going to Utah and Reno towards the end.
You know
what
that means, right,
dude?
That means fun.
Yeah, man. Utah spells fun.
That's married groupies.
That's right. Yeah, married groupies, and they all could be married to one guy.
That's right.
You're not kidding. And they don't fight for like a band member. They're like all okay. They're like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, yeah. We can all share them.
Yeah, there's Brody seven too. Of us. It's legal for all of us to want to hump you.
It's a weird state, man. Were you going to be in Salt Lake City?
Salt Lake City,
It's a little trippy, man. I mean, you feel the weight of the theocracy, you know what I mean?
Yes, like, you do.
No badness here.
And there's nothing hotter than, like, hooking up with a fine girl that is very religious.
Here's the thing about Utah.
You know, like that old joke, like, what's the only meat that priests eat?
Yeah, right.
None.
Here's an interesting story about Utah. It does. You do get that feeling. You know, they have their ways and they're very firm about it.
Yeah.
But they're really, really looking forward to like walling out.
Oh yeah.
And
when
a rock band comes to town, that is an opportunity to wall out, because the things that occur on that bus go away.
It doesn't stay there,
so they can get away with with coming out, and
sure.
I don't have a problem with it.
What
you
goes
know?
On the bus stays on the
you
bus.
Know, we bring it with us.
I actually have a great explanation of why they water down their beer.
Why?
Because they allow you to marry seven women. If you get drunk, you're going to go crazy.
That's right. You can't get too drunk.
If you get too drunk, you're going to wind up going nuts.
Yeah, and you can't do what you have to do for seven women if you're too drunk all the time.
No, then you'll have whiskey pee-pee.
The truth is, they water down the beer and they just drink more of it.
Yeah, have you got any weird moments on the road so far? Has anything been like, you know, dude, what the hell was that about?
The other day in Phoenix, Tempe, Arizona, it felt like
that
the day was going by so slow.
Yeah.
That's really the only weird things that ever happened.
No. I think they were like spirits in the air in Phoenix. It was a weird vibe. And then the opening band got into a fight with each other, and they kicked out the keyboard player.
During the set?
No, not during the set. This happened, you know, throughout the night. It was just a weird night, man.
Yeah.
I think that it was... My ex-girlfriend is actually from Tempe, and she summoned Satan to just lurk over the venue that night.
That must have been it. Yeah,
I like the way you say ex...
Yeah.
She became the ex that morning.
Yes.
Oh, so that might have been part of the bad trip there.
Yeah, it's like, thanks,
my girl didn't
honey.
Leave me, and I was feeling the vibe.
It's like, thanks, honey, I come to your hometown, and you dump me. Great. Screw you.
So that must have been an extra anger set. Did you bring it on stage with you?
Oh, no. The only words I had to say is I left my heart in Arizona.
All right,
that
man.
Was it.
Well, look, you guys, they're going to, this is El Nino. I don't mean to mispronounce it. I'm such an idiot.
Okay,
I'm going to try and get your name right. Cristian Machado.
Machado.
And Laz Pina, thanks for dropping by. Have
Thank
a great
you very
tour.
Much, man. Appreciate it.
Enjoy the music. Take care.
Right on, man.
Thank you.
War Nation Underground is the name of the album. Pick it up if you don't have it.
Now, Connect the Dots
with Mark Maron. With Mark Maron.
Yeah, I'm right
Connect
here.
The Dots.
I'm here, man. I'm just sorry. I was working on a multi-vector calculus problem here on my paper. Now, I don't even go into it, man. I'm just in my hobby. It's a hobby of mine. You know I did multi-vector calculus?
Hey, you know, I did know that about you. I knew that you were
Sometimes
a mathematician.
Sometimes I'm just doodling around and doing multi-vector calculus.
Studying that stuff for years.
Sure. Hey, we got a caller, Dorothy from West Los Angeles. Hello, Dorothy. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Mark, it's actually John Zach, the NSA guy who's been tapping your phone. Say, you were kind of insensitive to your mom the last time you talked to her, you know?
She's fine. Don't worry. She's used to it.
Not really. She told me she's still kind of waiting for your attitude to change.
You were talking to my mother?
Only because we both care about you, Mark. And, I mean, it'd be even worse if she knew about the internet porn. You've got to pull back or at least develop a healthier fetish.
Don't talk to my mother.
You had the same picture up on your screen for an hour. Why don't you just save it as a file?
Because I don't want anyone to find it on my hard drive.
You know what? Oh, that's rich. That's you don't want him to find. That's cute.
That's it with that guy. You know what? The hell with that guy. That's it.
I
don't know why I'm emailing with a fan either. I don't know why I answer the phone when the NSA guy calls. I don't know.
You know, he's just playing you.
All right, look, laughing liberally, Saturday, June 3rd, go to ktlk.com for information. That's at the Wadsworth Theater in Westwood. I'm going to be on it. Rick Overton, Will Durst, Jim David. He's a funny guy. I haven't seen him in a while. Looking forward to working with him. Dean Obadala, who's been on this show and others, when we did the other show in the morning. It's going to be good times. June 3rd. Come down. How about that? Is that going to be fun or what? All right. Now, wait. Who's this now? All right. Isn't him again? All right. This is who? Tammy from Hollywood, it says. You're on the air with Mark Maron.
Hey, Mark. It's me, John Zach, the NSA guy. Has been tapping your phone. Yeah. Listen, are you going to return that Oh Brother, Where Art Thou DVD to the video store?
The Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Oh, my God, that's right. I rented it and forgot about it. God, that was like a week ago.
Yeah, 9 days ago. And it's a problem. See, I make a point of renting the same movies you do from the same store you rent them from, so this is kind of throwing me off. I mean, are you going to watch the thing or not?
Hey, are you stalking me?
Well, when it's done in the service of the United States government, it's not called stalking. I break into your house and try on your clothes sometimes, and that's called patriotism. By the way, you and I have the same inseam. Isn't that funny? We could be brothers. You know? You gotta hang out. Hello?
I can't take it anymore. I can't take it with this guy. All right, look, folks, I don't want you to be caught off guard or uninformed, Jim. All right, Jim? So there's the... is everything all right, man?
Yeah, it's fine, man.
Yeah, I think we're taking. I understand we're taking Monday off. Is that my understanding?
I think we are. We're gonna have a best of. We're gonna have a.
Well, I think we should do an all comedy show.
Archive comedy show.
Yeah, like all the comedy bits from our tenure here on the Mark Maron Show.
Yeah, a lot of stuff.
Perhaps that people have never even heard. Well, look, here's the second edition of the Mark Maron Show Short Order News for today. Kenneth Lay and Jeffrey Skilling were convicted today of conspiracy to commit securities and wire fraud in one of the biggest business scandals in U.S. history. Lay and Skilling face at least 25 years each in prison or in white-collar crime years, 6 months with good behavior and $1 million book deal. Lay was convicted of all six charges against him, while Skilling got only 19 out of 28 in what his lawyer called... an honest accounting error. House Republicans and Democratic leaders are jointly demanding the FBI return documents taken in Capitol Hill raid on Representative William Jefferson's office. A lot of W's. Political analysts say this is the most significant agreement between the two parties since they decided to cover up the Kennedy assassination. I think that's a little over the top.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was over the top for them to cover that up. Yeah. The Warren Commission thing?
Yeah, but this doesn't match that. Maybe I'm wrong. Houston, Texas, rates first in the nation for the number of postal employees bitten by dogs, with Orange County, California coming in second. Metropolitan Los Angeles is a major center for dog bites, but experts say dog biting is a problem anywhere a Rottweiler is the smartest member of the family. And didn't even get laughing at it. He didn't do nothing. He actually just looked at me with this sort of like, Is this the end of the bit face? That was the end of the bit face he was giving me. Laughing Andy.
No.
Like he doesn't quite know where he ends, and then he'll slowly fade out the music like we're not going to notice it.
You know why? Because
what?
Andy's a clown.
And that's the short order news. Hey, what happened? See? I don't understand. What the hell is that? He went out a little early on the music, Laughing Andy. All right. Tomorrow we got the comedian Ungayo Bilim who's going to talk about
pot and sex. And more pot.
Former Senator of Colorado Gary Hart will hear to talk about
sex and pot.
No.
And
yeah.
More sex.
Vic Garbarini is going to talk about music. Guy's been in the music critic for years. Used to be a musician magazine, right? And now he's got some other magazines that I'll be more efficient with the information tomorrow.
And he was a character on Welcome Back, Kotter.
This is going to piss people off. Jason Leopold is going to be here tomorrow. We're going to get on him about it. See you later, sheeple. Condom candy.